From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee series wraps up with how a region-wide water management plan could have significant impact on the area's clean water supply.
Later, the positive gardening spin that comes from our anemic spring weather.
Bubbler Talk unearths the truth behind the smell that wafts over the Hone Bridge.
And how a period of bipolar mania fueled a new novel by Bill Zaffaros.
I became a man on a mission. I wrote it in 3 months. My daughters, they remember that seems to be all I did during that period. I missed an entire college basketball season. And it flowed for some reason.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. This week, we've been exploring the challenges the region experiences in ensuring a supply of clean water to its citizens. Project Milwaukee, Great Lakes Troubled Waters, has been asking the fundamental question of why. With so much of the world's fresh water right next to us, why is water access such an issue?
Experts say one of the ways forward is through a more comprehensive water management plan for the region and beyond. And they point to places around the world that have put plans into place that have yielded positive results. Jenny Kale is an associate professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences and Global Water Security Scholar at UW-Milwaukee, and she joins me and environmental reporter Susan Bentz in the studio. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you, what do you think good water management plans have in common?
I think good water management plans have an emphasis on conservation and not consumption, which sounds obvious. But I think one of the things that we often look at is how to market our region as a water rich region, which it is, but I want to make sure that a water stewardship plan in this region really looks at conservation as the priority, as opposed to selling our water or bringing in water-intensive industries to this area specifically to take advantage of our water, as opposed to attracting water businesses and water-intensive industries and agriculture as a function of our water responsibility and our stewardship and maybe some reputational benefits to those companies of locating here and being part of a responsible water management plan, again, as opposed to having it be more of an extractive exercise.
There are some cities, some metropolitan areas people typically point to as places that have taken a proactive approach in these areas and are generally doing it right when it comes to managing their water supply and distribution. I was going to name names, but I guess I'm curious to have you name names. When you look around in this field as you do, what do you look to as the places that have gotten it right?
In addition to Milwaukee, of course, we have a lot of great expertise and leadership in this region. But I think, you know, it's too parochial to say that we can't learn from other amazing cities in the nation and worldwide that are doing good work. Philadelphia has a particularly strong stormwater management plan, one of the most forward-thinking in the country.
And how so?
They can capture more than the first inch of stormwater in the city. And, you know, it's a large urban area, very densely populated, and they've done a remarkable job at building in ways to capture stormwater. Green
the
space.
The first inch is typically how much you would expect?
They can
capture the more than the first inch, but
right. And so Milwaukee, for example, is aspiring to capture the first half inch.
Oh, wow.
Right. So Philadelphia is doing really quite well in that area. New York, as you know, is managing its drinking water very effectively by managing natural areas as opposed to destroying those natural areas and then having to put in a $6 billion water management system. Stockholm's doing a great job managing, in particular, its garbage waste and its stormwater runoff that contaminates the water. So it's doing a really good job looking at all of the factors that contribute to water pollution and keeping its water clean in that way. So there are definitely some remarkable examples that we can look to.
So are there cities that fold the two together, the drinking end and then through that stormwater and processing? Because that's something that I think people here in Milwaukee are talking about. Can we establish that kind of big comprehensive program?
I would look to Stockholm right now as the model city worldwide in doing that.
We should.
It is a good place. And it does have a much more integrated approach. I think it does, you know, really look at food and food waste as well as production of material goods, plastics in particular. It looks at its recycling programs. It looks at its housing projects. It looks at stormwater management in terms of what's running off of its streets. It looks at green spaces and infrastructure. And it looks at all of that as a function of the effects on drinking water, which usually we look at the front end of drinking water. Where's the water coming from, as opposed to the back end, which is, you know, where's the wastewater going and how do we treat it before it gets back into the system and then, again, turns into drinking water later. But they've done a really good job at integrating all of those contributing factors. It's important for us here because we get our drinking water from Lake Michigan, and so we do pay attention to, you know, what is going into the rivers that contribute to the lake and what the quality of that water system as a whole is. So I think we've done a pretty good job at considering that here. But I think we definitely need to increase the priority of that conversation.
Well, and you mentioned New York and its ability mm-hmm. to kind of manage the natural areas so that they have them and don't have to replace them with a prohibitively expensive system.
Right.
What is New York doing to kind of hang on to those spaces so that they serve the natural functions that they do in terms of ensuring that the drinking water supply is safe?
I'm glad you mentioned that it's prohibitively expensive to put in a new, you know, built system to treat that water, because I'd like to think that, you know, it's environmental ethics and humanistic effort to keep that environment clean. But, you know, from a policy perspective, it really does have a very strong economic component that compels decision makers to try to maintain that system. So I think, of course, they have to have all of those components, the environmental component, the ethical component of conservation, but it also does have to have the economic component to compel policymakers often. And I think, you know, part of the economic impetus for maintaining that natural environment keeps businesses out of range, right, or keeps businesses in a sustainable framework. And I think that's hard to do in a major urban area. But really what they're doing is they're keeping the toxic pollution out of the system before it reaches the system, because, as you know, it's technically possible but very difficult to get those toxins out of the water once it's in the system, and they recognize that. And it's cost prohibitive to get it out of the system once it's in the system. So they've recognized the interdependence of the environment and the economy, and they've actually recognized that it's more cost effective for them to keep those water intensive and water polluting businesses quite a distance away. And they've had them invest in other areas, right? And they have paid somewhat of an economic cost for that, but they recognize the financial trade-off in the long run is worth it. Now, I would say the priorities are changing and that there is even a stronger environmental ethic that is driving that, as opposed to solely an economic benefit, because I think there's much more of a reputational gain for New York than there was in the past. Because now, as is Milwaukee, a lot of cities are looking to New York to figure out how are they doing it? Where are they putting the businesses? Where are they putting the polluters? How are they keeping the toxins out of the system in the first place and why? And I think they appreciate being turned to as a model for replication.
Do you think places like New York and Philadelphia, are they able to act regionally in a way that is challenging to this area?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it that way. Regionally in terms of the density of population or the interconnectedness of cities, the relationship between New York and Philadelphia as opposed to Milwaukee and Chicago.
Well, I mean, the relationship between New York and its surrounding communities, the relationship between Philadelphia and its suburbs. I mean, I think when we look at the situation in Milwaukee, I think a lot of people point to the fact that you have, you know, sort of competing priorities. When you look, you know, within the city of Milwaukee, it's dealing with one set of issues. And when you go not very far away to the other side of the Sunny Slope Road, it's a whole different set of issues. And when you go to the south, it's a whole different set of issues. And so I'm wondering if there's something more unifying about what they deal with in a place like New York or Philadelphia versus, you know, the kind of microclimates that we have, probably to mix a metaphor here, an environmental metaphor, in the Milwaukee area.
Yes, I would agree with that characterization. I think it would hold to be more similar to Milwaukee on a larger scale. So urban Philadelphia has much more in common with urban Milwaukee than it does with rural Pennsylvania. And the same with New York. Right, upstate New York or rural New York has a lot less in common with urban New York than New York City has with the metropolitan area. But because of the function of those being cities and metropolitan areas of many millions of people, and you know, many, many miles of densely populated areas, I think there is a solidarity in those areas and an understanding of interdependence that isn't broken for many miles outside of the city. And there's a common understanding of the interdependence of where the water comes from and what pollutes it. And that is helpful. And I do think it's that sense of city solidarity that really does spark a lot of that innovation and the kind of collective understanding of their fate, essentially. I don't mean to be too dramatic about it, but that's essentially what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think, as you mentioned, Southern Wisconsin in particular has some of the greatest wealth of the state. It has some of the greatest urban elements and assets of the state. It also has some of the most remote rural areas. It also has some of the most deeply impoverished urban areas, as well as some of the most deeply impoverished rural areas. It's got such a wide set of stakeholders. It's got some of the most influential people. It's got some of the most vulnerable people. It's got some of the best water systems in the state. It's got some of the worst water problems in the state. And so, you know, it's definitely got some challenges in terms of identifying where our shared priorities are and where our shared challenges and our shared opportunities are.
So what do you think the potentials are here? I mean, where does Milwaukee stand in your estimation? And how do we move forward toward a plan?
Well, I think we're fortunate in three respects. We have a lot of expertise here. We have some good water leadership in the area. And I believe we have a genuine commitment to the issues of water stewardship. And I'm thankful for that because some cities don't have that. They haven't prioritized it or gotten it high enough on the political agenda yet. And I think Milwaukee is certainly moving it high enough on the political agenda to have a real impact. I think some of the best areas of opportunity are in green infrastructure because we have some of the policies in place to advance it and incentivize it. I think in terms of creating blue-green jobs and some of the industries here and some of the businesses that are coming together to create places where our water experts and our water leaders can stay in Wisconsin and lead and develop here as opposed to having to go to other places is a real advantage to keep those minds here. Is a real asset to the state as well. I think we have some creative thinkers. I think we have some people who are trying to understand where the real water inefficiencies are and the real inequities are. And I think that's a good first step. I think a lot of people misidentify where the real water problems actually are. And I think we're overcoming that step by step in Milwaukee. So, for example, residential use is only 10% of water use and consumption. So it's important that we have water-efficient appliances and that we not water our lawns in the middle of the day. And I think it's great that a lot of residents in both urban and rural areas are taking personal responsibility for that. However, I think there's a really important recognition, particularly in an agriculture-intensive state, that 70% of the water used in the state for human consumption is in the agricultural sector. And that affects Milwaukee because we eat that food. I enjoy it every day. And I'm dependent on it, as are most people in urban areas, right? And the inefficiencies in that agricultural sector affect the lake from which we get our drinking water in the city, and it affects our water ethic and our water responsibilities in the urban areas because we rely very heavily on that food as well. So I think understanding that interdependence is something that Milwaukeeans are getting much better at.
Do you think it's too much to ask to have a water management plan that brings in the stakeholders from both Milwaukee but also from far-flung places mm-hmm. in Wisconsin where agriculture is really running the show when it comes to water use?
No, I think it's imperative. I mean, water obviously crosses political boundaries. It crosses jurisdictions. It crosses economic interests. And so in order to have a comprehensive water plan or to put a water policy in place that's going to be effective, you have to include all of those stakeholders, the most influential stakeholders, the most urban stakeholders, the most vulnerable stakeholders, the most rural stakeholders. The agricultural sector is powerful in Wisconsin, but it's also very expensive to be a farmer, right? And a lot of people are leaving the business in Wisconsin right now. And we want to support people who want to feed people. And that's really where the nobility of that profession comes from. And we want to make sure they can survive here. And I've found that including people in the agricultural sector really does break some of the preconceived notions that they want to put chemical pesticides and fertilizers on their properties, for example. They're dependent on that soil for their livelihoods as well. And so I think opening that conversation to a variety of stakeholders really is essential in terms of understanding what's necessary and what's feasible in the state.
Is this, I mean, if we're talking here at home where we're sitting mm-hmm. very close to Lake Michigan, are we talking about a watershed-based water management plan, or mm-hmm. is it broader than that?
I think we need to have a watershed management plan for every watershed, and I think we need to have a statewide water policy in place. I also think we need to have a national water policy in the same way we need to have an energy policy so that we know what the directives are, what our values are, what it is our aspirations are as a country. But at the state level, I think it's really important for Wisconsinites to understand we have a very strong environmental history in the state. We've got Aldo Leopold. We've got a lot of very strong environmentalists, a lot of good current water scholars. We've got Gaylord Nelson, who started Earth Day, and it was very involved, right, in trying to understand the interconnectedness of environmental and economic issues. So I think we need to harken back to some of those traditional values in the state of Wisconsin and make sure that we are developing a statewide water policy to direct us into the future. It's not a partisan politics kind of issue. Everybody drinks water. Everybody eats food. Everybody, wants or I anticipate that everybody wants, the future generations of Wisconsin to be able to survive. That's not too dramatic, right? There are some pretty serious challenges that we're facing. I think everyone wants us to be able to address uncertainties and vulnerabilities, and I think people would appreciate some deliberate thought and direction in that area. And so I think a statewide water policy is called for. But to add some specifics to that, we would need watershed policies in place, right, or watershed plans in place that address the specifics of each region. And that can only really be done if we do cross those political jurisdictions and those boundaries and those economic interests particular to those regions.
So in the other cities that you talked about, has it been business leaders or water leaders or who have spearheaded these activities in other places?
It has been a combination of business leaders, certainly a strong solidarity between the non-governmental organizations of all kinds, any organization that is obviously a water-related organization, but other organizations that have a water component of any kind, green infrastructure organizations, urban agriculture organizations, equity organizations, economic development organizations, those kinds of organizations, environmental justice organizations, public health organizations, all have a stake in what happens with the water and sustainable development in cities and the surrounding areas. I also think that the universities in a lot of areas have led in research. They have nonpartisan research that they can conduct and hopefully contribute, especially public universities in particular. They have a role in serving their community and their states, and I think they've done in most areas, a pretty good job of contributing to that conversation and pushing it forward. And I think between those three pillars, between, the service organizations, the universities, and the business organizations, I think anywhere that you can build on those three pillars together, you've got a pretty solid group of leaders you can count on to move things forward pretty quickly.
So I'm assuming a city like New York has taken into account infrastructure and mm-hmm. existing and what needs to be replaced and how it has to be visioned for the future. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yes. And unfortunately, some natural disasters have changed some of the modeling for cities, New York included. So
we're talking about the flooding they had.
Right. The flooding mm-hmm. that they've had. And it's an unfortunate way to improve those models. But, when the subways flood, they can figure out where that water's actually going to go. And so there's been improvements through some of those natural disasters and the future modeling to build resilience in a variety of new ways and, just trying to bring home the realities of the uncertainties that we face. One of the important challenges there is how do we make policy decisions in the context of those uncertainties? And that's one area in which that set of three pillars is really important: universities, businesses, non-governmental organizations, and then, of course, the municipalities. And the political leadership in those municipalities has to participate, because they have to understand as best they can the uncertainties and find ways to make decisions in the context of those uncertainties. And that's something that we're not particularly good at doing yet.
Jenny Kale, thank you so much for your perspective on this. It's been really illuminating.
Thank you for doing the series. I appreciate it.
Jenny Kale is an associate professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences and Global Water Security Scholar at UW-Milwaukee.
We will take a quick break now and then learn one gardening technique that can also make a difference in reducing runoff and improving water quality. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We're back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. You don't need us to tell you that it has been a cool, damp spring. But what you might not know is that with the right kind of garden in your yard, the weather we've been having can play a role in helping to improve water quality.
Author, garden expert, and Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers is with us in the studio to explain. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's always great to be here, Mitch.
So let's start with maybe a pretty obvious point. This has not been the easiest spring to get out in the garden.
You bet. Besides the cooler temperatures and a few warm days in between, we haven't seen a lot of sunshine. And so waiting for the soil to dry and warm is really critical to start a successful growing season.
Well, and I guess the question I have, and maybe you don't have meteorological data in front of you, but you know, it's maybe not all that unusual to have a cool spring. I mean, it seems like I feel like Memorial Day is the day that we really look at as the milepost for when growing really starts here anyway.
I think we're all anxious. I think the winter started later and it was pretty severe. And so I think that had us all anxious for spring. I think all the gray, wet days slowed things down. Honestly, I was telling somebody I just finished cleaning out the winter interest a week ago because I couldn't get in the garden.
Yep.
Any day I had off, it poured down rain. And so I finally cleaned things up. The bulbs are looking great. Things are starting to peek through, and everybody's going, but it's not leafing out yet. It is early, you know. So that is one of the downsides. And gardeners, every year we face this. It has been cooler than normal, but the good news is because it's been cooler, if we have a late season frost, you're less likely to lose things because you haven't put them out too early because we had a couple of warm, sunny days.
Well, and the law of averages says it will get warmer.
Yes, exactly. It may be a while, but yes, it will get warmer.
So it seems like maybe a really appropriate subject for us to get into is the idea of rain gardens, partly because we're having this conversation. It is raining outside, and this seems like a perfect season to have a rain garden in place because it'll get a lot of use. Let's start with a basic question. What do we mean when we're talking about a rain garden?
I'm glad you asked because we as Midwesterners have really been leaders in this area, believe it or not. When I would speak on the East or West Coast and mention rain barrels and rain gardens and keeping water where it falls, I'd get this blank stare, you know, and I said, oh, we're trendsetters here in the Midwest. But not all of us have been involved with it. So this is a great place to start. So the idea of a rain garden is to capture water coming off your roof, your drive, your patio, your lawn, and capturing it before it goes into the storm sewer. And that way, by capturing the water there, you're keeping it where it falls. The plant roots and soil filter it before it goes down and recharges our groundwater. So it's removing dust particles, pesticides, and all those things we don't want in our waterways. It prevents overloading our storm sewers, which means less backup, less flooding, that type of thing. So you're helping your own landscape, and you're taking care of plants that can take it wet and dry. So this isn't a water garden. If you've got standing water for more than 48 hours, you have a water garden, not a rain garden. So positioning is important in the type of plants and soil prep, just like in any garden.
Okay, so then let's talk about positioning and what we need to do to keep our rain garden from just being a water garden.
So we want it on a slight slope away from the home. The last thing we need is more water by our foundation, at least 10 feet away from the foundation of your house, and then directing the water from your downspout into your rain garden. So some people will run an underground line. Some will just create a little swale and maybe some stones to direct the water to the rain garden. And some just allow it to naturally, by gravity, fill up that rain garden. So location, at least 10 feet away from your foundation of your house. The other thing you want to do is prepare the soil. Most of us in southeastern Wisconsin have heavy clay soil. And as you know, it drains very slowly. And this year's a good indication of how
yes,
slow it's
exactly.
draining. So we want to add organic matter to help improve drainage. And then if you have sandy, rocky soil, so if you're in the Kettle Moraine area, you may have more sand and rock. That's what I have now. And so adding organic matter holds the moisture. So when we have those hot, dry spells, we're not out there watering our rain garden. And then we're going to create a bit of an indentation so the water doesn't flow over and down to the storm
right.
sewer, but is rather captured in that rain garden.
Well, and so talk about appropriate kinds of things that grow and appreciate a rain garden.
You know, and that's one of the nice parts. Sometimes people have visions of, oh, it's going to be ugly. It isn't. Natives obviously are a good place to start because they support our birds and pollinators. And many of the native plants are subject to flooding and drought when you look at our natural conditions. So looking at things that are going to provide seasonal interest, so it's beautiful for you, supports the pollinators, plants that tolerate wet and dry soils, and then arranging them, one, based on how much moisture they can tolerate, because in the lowest part of your rain garden is going to stay wettest longer, on the edges is going to dry out quickly, and then arranging them so they're attractive to you. I think some of the initial rain gardens, maybe we were just so focused on the beauty of the natural plants that not everybody appreciated it the way some of us did. So here are some plants. For shady areas or partly sunny areas, columbine, which is an early season bloomer. Our native columbine is wonderful. Hummingbirds and butterflies love it, so we can help support the pollinators early. Also for shade to sun are the hyssops, lavender hyssop, which has kind of a spiky flower, some attractive foliage, blooms for a couple of months, so that's another nice option to use. As we move into some of the later in the season, things like swamp milkweed, great for the monarchs because the caterpillars need the milkweed to feed on the leaves, and the flowers attract many different butterflies and even hummingbirds. And swamp milkweed is native to marshy wet areas, but will also take it dry. It grows about 4 feet tall and is a little less aggressive than common milkweed, which is great for the monarchs, but sometimes people get frustrated keeping it contained.
You talk about the dry periods. Are there things that when you have a rain garden you need to do in the event of a long dry spell?
I'm glad you brought that up, because a couple years ago we did have a pretty hot dry spell, and any new gardens you're going to need to water because those plants will tolerate flooding and drought once established, but that first year they really need that extra TLC. So getting them started this year may not be a problem, but depending on the rain, you know, we get a lot of rain and then it stops. So making sure those root systems are kept thoroughly moistened. So water thoroughly to encourage good deep roots. Check the top couple inches. If it's crumbly and moist, it's time to water again. Mulching the soil surface, using something that's organic so that as it breaks down, it will help improve the soil. Sometimes twice shredded bark. The benefit of that is it knits together and doesn't wash away. I use a lot of shredded leaves, but you kind of have to watch how the water comes in. So you may need to use a combination of things. I'm big about using resources right on your property. So most of us have leaves, either ours or our neighbors, blowing in the yard. Evergreen needles also. But watch the flow of water and adjust just like you do with any garden. So proper watering, especially the first year, especially during extended droughts. And then even the second year, keep an eye on how well they're doing. If you're using many of our natives, the reason they do so well is they know how to propagate and spread. So every few years, you're going to need to dig and divide. You could start another rain garden with all your plants. Share them with your friends as long as you don't have jumping worms. And that's an invasive worm. Uh-huh. And we don't want to share those. And that's a great way to make your investment go even further.
Is there any other kind of maintenance that's specific to rain gardens versus any other kinds of plantings?
The main thing is making sure soil prep is even more critical than with any garden. It's critical for any garden, but more so with rain gardens. This is hopefully a permanent planting like other perennial gardens. So you want to do it right initially. Mulching is a regular process, as you know, as a gardener. You know, in your regular gardens, if you use organic mulches, they do break down. But the nice part is they're improving the soil. You want to make sure when you're digging your rain garden and you've got one side bermed so the water doesn't wash over the top, just making sure that berm, that raised area on the downward side of your raised garden is intact. Now, if you're running your downspout underneath the ground, you will have that mound all the way around so that you're really managing the water that goes in and slowing the flow so it doesn't end up in the storm sewer.
Are there pest concerns that are specific to rain gardens, things that like to breed in water?
Good question. So that's the key about you don't want standing water for 48 hours, so you shouldn't have mosquito issues. So good question, because I'm sure a lot of people are thinking the last thing I want is standing water. If you are getting standing water, then it's time to look at is your rain garden big enough to handle the water? Maybe you need a second one. If you have areas where you have temporary flooding, and this wouldn't be so much in your rain garden, but one cool thing that I discovered is those mosquito dunks that are Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacteria, naturally occurring soil bacteria that only kills the larvae of mosquitoes, black flies and fungus gnats. But if you put one of those on a stake, if you have areas that are subject to maybe spring floods, put one on a stake. If it's standing water, that releases that bacteria that kills the mosquito larva. But in a rain garden, that shouldn't be an issue. The other thing, if you are getting overflows, maybe it's time to install a rain barrel. And then the overflow goes to your rain garden so that you're managing the water a little bit better. If you're like, I'm not redigging this rain garden, it isn't big enough, I don't have a space for a second one, then looking at another step. And then amending your lawn soil as well. You know, core aerating, top dressing with compost. I know that's a lot of work, but adding that organic matter will help improve drainage, and it makes your lawn more of a sponge. So your lawn will be healthier, it will drain better, and that might be another way if you haven't planned correctly. The good thing is Fresh Coast Guardians has some really good step-by-step information on how big your rain garden needs to be, you know, details on amending the soil and how deep you need to dig it so that you get and manage the water where it falls and don't create a problem, but rather a solution to keeping water where it falls.
We will link people to that advice.
Excellent.
And Melinda Myers, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening, including The Midwest Gardener's Handbook and Month-by-Month Gardening in Wisconsin. She's also Lake Effect's gardening contributor, and you can listen back to previous interviews at WUWM.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The Hone Bridge. It's a Milwaukee landmark and a daily route for many of the city's commuters. But perhaps you've noticed a certain smell that infiltrates your car as you're driving.
Oh, what is that?
Ew.
Oh, that's not good.
I'm Audrey Nowakowski, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, a listener named Terry asked, what's that rotten egg smell driving over the Hone Bridge? Well, to find out, I took a trip to Jones Island to meet Bill Graffin, Public Information Manager for the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District.
It's a tough call where exactly it's coming from, but when you're driving over the bridge over the wastewater treatment plant, probably a good guess that it's coming from here.
Jones Island has been home to MMSD's wastewater treatment facility since 1926. In other words, it's where your sewage goes when you flush the toilet, run your garbage disposal, or spit toothpaste down the drain. However, it turns out that that crap you smell is actually doing a lot of good.
We treat wastewater here, and we also have a distinctive smell that comes from the production of malorganite, which is a fertilizer that we've been making since 1926 and selling around the country.
Malorganite stands for Milwaukee Organic Nitrogen. This organic fertilizer is made with that wastewater you smell. Here's how. First, the screening process takes out all large objects from the untreated water. Then, it's off to the settling tanks, where oil and grease float to the top and solids sink to the bottom. The third step is a secondary treatment that involves microscopic organisms, also known as the good bugs.
Those organisms, or bugs, eat organic material out of the water. They clean the water. They're the workhorses of wastewater treatment. And we take a certain percentage of those bugs out of the mix every day and reintroduce the rest back into the tanks to clean the water. And we take those bugs and we put them into this big, huge building, the Milorganite factory, and we squeeze the water out of them. We put them in these huge dryers and tumble them to certain pellet sizes, and then they're sold as fertilizer around the country.
What water is left from the treatment process is disinfected with the chlorine byproduct that is then neutralized before it's returned to Lake Michigan.
The water that goes out of the plant is much, much cleaner than what comes in. And, you know, we have a pretty good track record meeting treatment standards that are above and beyond what the state and the federal government calls for.
So depending on the wind direction or even the season, Bill Graffin says the smells are just a part of living in the city.
Well, there's no question that it is a beneficial reuse, but if it's an odor to someone, it's an odor. You can't explain your way out of that one. Right. If people don't like it, I don't know what to say, except we're looking at it. We're trying to come up with some solutions here.
And if you are skeptical about using biosolids such as malorganite in your garden or on your lawn, Graffin says that its 91-year history and counting speaks for its quality.
People love malorganite. I mean, the golf course superintendents, the master gardeners, people who really know their stuff know it's a great product, and it's a slow release fertilizer that just is fantastic. It, you know, we call it goof-proof because you really can't screw it up.
But if the smell truly does bother you, you can always plug your nose as you drive over the bridge. Just remember to keep the other hand on the steering wheel.
One more break, and then how some challenging life circumstances fueled a creative burst that led to a new novel by Milwaukee writer Bill Zafiros. We'll talk with him when Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mental illness can be a hindrance to living a comfortable and productive life. But there are some illnesses that can also spark creativity as well. Artists from Kurt Cobain to Vincent van Gogh were subject to manic episodes that led to periods of intense artistic creation, but they also hastened their deaths.
Former journalist and Milwaukee Public Relations executive Bill Zafiros has dealt with similar issues. And while his mental health is in a better place now, his formerly untreated condition contributed to the creation of his first novel called Poison Pen, which comes out next week. Bill Zafiros, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Can you share the story of the period of time during which this book came to be?
Sure. At the time, I was undiagnosed and unmedicated for bipolar disorder. And ideas would click into my head, and sometimes I pursued them. Sometimes they were good ideas. Sometimes they were very bad ideas. In this case, I happened to walk past the family computer, and the name Poison Pen popped into my head. And I thought to myself, let's write a story about a guy who writes poison pen letters. So I sat down and started banging it out, and I became a man on a mission. I wrote it in 3 months. My daughters say they remember that seems to be all I did during that period. I missed an entire college basketball season, at least after Christmas. And it flowed for some reason. As I said, I was a man on a mission.
How much of that period do you remember? I mean, this was even without what you were going through, this was, what, 19 years ago or so,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I remember writing the book. I remember going through the various highs and lows that bipolars are famous for. But as I read the book during editing, I would ask myself, where did you come up with this? And I thought, well, it all holds together anyway. But I had, in some cases, no idea or no remembrance of having come up with this or that plot twist. One of them I know, which I can't mention or it'll ruin the book, but the rest of it was sort of the product of a manic high.
Do you feel like in some ways you have kind of a postcard or a snapshot of who you were and what was going through your mind at this period of your life?
In some ways, yes. Some of the characters are purely figments of my imagination. But the protagonist, I think, may represent some of the things I was feeling at the time. He's not me. However, he represents some of the things that I believe and think. So,
well, and not to belabor the point, did you fully grasp what you were going through, the manic highs and the lows at the time, or did you just think this is who I am?
Not at the time. It wasn't until a mental crash about a year later that my doctor said, okay, are you ready to admit that you're bipolar? And I said, it's got to be something. So, yes. And he put me on the medications, and I have to admit that they kicked in very quickly. That's uncharacteristic of those types of drugs. It usually takes a week or two. But they kicked in very quickly, and I liken it to waking up from an alcoholic bender. You suddenly say to yourself, I did what? I did that? Oh, my God. You know, and so there's a sort of reckoning that comes along with finally being treated.
Let's talk a little about the characters who inhabit this book, which, you know, I have to say reads in many places like an outburst of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Your narrator, whose name we will not reveal because mm-hmm. he does not reveal it, he's an interesting piece of work. It's hard to know what to make of this guy.
Yeah. I think that one of the people who read the book early, my friend Thomas Peel, said, the character is very pissed off. And I think that's how I felt at the time. I was just fed up with a lot of things in society in general and thought I would commit it to paper in the guise of a character that I created.
And he's kind of in a place where he was stuck. He's stuck in this small, weird Wisconsin town living with his yes. grandfather, who is maybe even more of a piece of work.
Exactly. Well, I have to say that I have lived in small towns. If you consider Appleton a small town, I lived in Appleton for some time when I was a newspaper reporter. I lived in Dover, Delaware, population 20,000. And I never liked
it. You did not live with a grandfather who wears grass skirts, though.
I did not. Okay. I did not. No. That was, again, a figment of my imagination. But I grew to, unfortunately, dislike small towns. And that is reflected in the creation of Hammertown.
And into his life, we mentioned his grandfather inhabits this novel. But into this guy's life enters first Pinky and then Jerry.
Yes, yes.
Tell us a little bit about each of them and the role they play I'm not sure exactly how long the time period is that the book plays out over, but...
It's over a couple of days.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, over a couple of days. And the plot is linear, so you don't have any time shifts right. or anything like that. Pinky Lee is, again, another creation. She is a very eccentric character. She likes to challenge people to do things that they don't want to do because she finds it interesting. She's a little controlling. Jerry Most is a very dislikable character and, frankly, doesn't represent anything in my personality. But you have to have some conflict in there. And
he's a guy that's working to redeem himself.
Yes. He is a very obnoxious, very caustic game show host who humiliates wives, who humiliates contestants on his show, who just is a bit of a jerk. And he
kind
begins,
of the living embodiment of a poison pen letter.
Exactly, exactly. He begins to realize that maybe that's not the way to go. And the book follows. I'm never really sure who's the main character, Jerry or the protagonist.
And I wondered, as I was reading this, if I was going to come across a point at which we find out that Jerry is actually a figment of the main character's imagination and mm-hmm. that they are actually two parts of his personality that are kind of squaring off.
Yeah. The protagonist clearly does not like Jerry, and he enjoys antagonizing him. And Jerry fires back. There's a lot of repartee in this book. And going back to being manic and remembering how I did this, it was literally I don't mean to sound like this is a part of the mental illness, but when I write, I hear what I'm going to write before I write it. There's this voice that says this is what should happen. And the repartee that goes on, I realized that for every antagonistic statement, there had to be a response. And normally it was sarcastic. And in some cases, mean-spirited. But I like to think it's almost always funny.
Well, and a great example of this and probably some things that were going through your head at the time is this kind of rant that your main character goes on maybe like two-thirds of the way through the novel where we
right.
really kind of get to appreciate just where his mind is. And maybe I've set it up for you, but I don't know if you want to set it up a little more and then just share. It goes on for a while in a kind of a great way, actually. But
right.
We'd like to hear some of it, I think.
Sure. This is a part where the protagonist is talking to Jerry Most about Jerry is trying to redeem himself, and the protagonist seems to feel that there is no such thing as redemption. So he says, "Want to know what my problem is with my colleagues in the human race? I'll tell you. It's that we have evolved into such an advanced state, yet we still behave like apes. The big push the little around, the rich screw the poor, it's always me first. The list of what I hate about this culture is so long we'd have to talk straight through to lunch for me to get through all of it. But I'll give you an idea. What's really getting to me is the and gas-guzzling SUVs who drive on your 80 miles an hour on the highway because they know if there's a crash, they live and you die. And the same goes for the so-called knights of the road, the semi-drivers, who treat all vehicles in front of them as though they were flies on their windshields. It's get out of the way or die for these Neanderthals. These people are bullies, low-life scum who only feel good about themselves because they drive big vehicles and make enough money to move to neighborhoods where they are so far away from the city that they're guaranteed not to see a black or a brown person or a car that's more than 2 years old. I hate people because for years they were only willing to sell their dignity on a game show for a patio set, and now we're willing to risk their very lives on their shows. Yet they all profess some religious pomposity that makes me want to puke blood. I'm sick of people who leave their cell phones on in theaters and operas, people who give you dirty looks when you tell them to shut the f*** up when they talk during a movie. I'm tired of people who insist they have smokers' rights in all public places, and I'm tired of ninnies who insist on fighting with the smokers about where they smoke. I'm sick of the smokers who dispose of their butts as though the whole world was an ashtray. I'm tired of silly suburbanites who are willing to leap into the next status-ridden fad that they are willing to embrace the most ridiculous game in the world, soccer, for themselves and for their kids. Soccer, for God's sake! And I'm sick to death of people who worship that silly pseudo-Euro sport so blindly that they're willing to call sports editors at newspapers they don't even subscribe to, let alone read, and demand more coverage of European soccer, or worse yet, their stupid kids' peewee league soccer scores. I'm sick to the point of retching of people who say baseball is boring because they're too stupid to understand it. I hate living in a world where artists like Madonna are considered anything other than homely exhibitionists instead of pop icons. I hate people who insist on referring to those lowing cattle, Celine Dion or Mariah Carey, as divas when they've never heard a real diva sing.
Bill Zafros reading from Poison Pen, and we kind of get the just kind of the state that your narrator is coming from. So we talked about the period in which this story came to be, but again, that is a long time ago. How did it, almost two decades later, turn into the physical thing that's in front of us now?
Well, for a long time, I left it on a shelf, probably about 16 years.
That is a long time.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was any good. And it was sort of something I checked off on the to-do list. And I wasn't sure if I ever intended to get it published. I finally trusted a friend to read it. And she said, dude, you have to get this published. And I thought, okay, you know, family and friends had read it, but they have to like it. But this woman said, you have to get it published. So step two is getting it published. That's not an easy thing to do. And I didn't circulate it because rejection is free and plentiful, and I didn't want to seek it out. Finally, a friend mentioned that he had a student who published books, Kira Henschel of Henschel House in Bayview. And I sent her the manuscript after he introduced us electronically. And she wrote back 2 weeks later with a statement in the subject line, here comes the new Carl Hiaasen. So I assumed she liked it, and she published it.
I imagine that after so long on the shelf, there was a little editing and a little polishing it up and maybe some updating of it that you wanted to do?
Yeah, some of the cultural references. I had to keep it in that time, around the turn of the 21st century. But I also had to eliminate some anachronisms, references to VCRs and things like that. I had to read the book 10 times, and every time I read it, I found something I wanted to change. So by the time I had read it that many times, and my editor had read it, and my publisher had read it, I felt like it was ready to go. If I read it again, I'd probably find something else to change.
Considering what you had been going through at the time that you wrote this book, was it at all like an out-of-body experience to sort of revisit your writing from that time?
Absolutely. In fact, several times while reading it and editing it, I didn't remember having written a certain aspect of it. But to be honest, thinking, hey, that's pretty good. I like that. And I'm not used to doing that with my own stuff, but I sometimes impressed myself with what I did.
Does it strike you as odd? I mean, because you've been on medication for bipolar for a long time now. Does it strike you as odd to think that if you had started your medication earlier, this book may never have come to be?
Hard to say. I've always wanted to write a book. I think that in some ways, channeling mental illness into creativity helped me do this. I'm working on a second book, and unfortunately, working on this book has prevented me from really advancing it farther than 20,000 words, but I am working on a second book, and I'm handling it just fine without leaving the meds.
Well, Bill Zafiros, congratulations on
Thank
the
you.
Book.
Thank you.
So long in the making, and best of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Bill Zafiros is a Milwaukee public relations executive and a former journalist. His new novel is called Poison Pen. The launch event for the book is next Wednesday evening at the Marcus Center. It will double as a fundraiser for the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Greater Milwaukee. You'll find a link to more about the book at WUWM.com. And that is the Friday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce Lake Effect along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, with assistant producer Maddie Andre and intern Zoe Munson. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Latoya Dennis and Susan Bentz this week.
Lauren Sigfrisson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski is the managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.